Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, my name's Mark Billingham, and welcome to A Stab in the Dark, UK TV's crime podcast that invites some of the biggest names from the worlds of crime fiction and TV crime drama to come into our incident room for a little natter. Regular listeners know that we've had some real heavyweights from the genre in this series, but if it's your first time, welcome along for the ride. This week, we've got a shorter episode for you, and it features our man with the spyglass, Paul Hirons, speaking with British author Sarah Pinborough at Crime Fest in Bristol. Sarah's written one of the most talked about bestsellers of the year, so this one should be fun. Paul, it's over to you.
Yes, thanks, Mark. As you mentioned, I'm here at Crime Fest in Bristol with none other than Sarah Pinborough. Welcome to A Stab in the Dark, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Behind Her Eyes is one of the most talked about books of the year.
Thank you.
Well, it is, isn't it?
Well, in my family.
Yes. But you must be delighted, though. And what's the feeling like when you put a book out there? If you know, you've been writing and editing, and then there's that kind of weird period of
waiting.
And then you actually get it out there, and it kind of causes this immense kind of reaction.
Well, I've been writing quite a long time, so this wasn't my first book, and I think if this had been my first book, I'd have had a very different view on, you know, I'm glad it wasn't. This has been, so I know that this is quite unusual, so I know that this isn't going to happen with every book. But it, you know, HarperCollins did a great job with the run-up to it. So they had the hashtag WTF that ending. Yeah. They had 3 rounds of proofs. So it was a really big marketing campaign. And they got the supermarkets on side. So I kind of hoped it was going to obviously do better than anything else because more money had been put behind it. But I was still really, you know, the week of release, you know.
You still got the nerves,
I was massively nervous. And you also, if, you know, people, a lot of people see publishers as these very cold business-like people. But when we hit number one, even when we went in at number two, my publicist cried, you know, because
really?
The whole team was so excited and everyone was watching it, the whole of the marketing team, because they'd all put so much work in. So with other books, I've kind of thought, oh, I hope my book does well. Whereas with this, it's always been, I hope our book does well, because
right, so
it's been
a team
massive
thing,
team
right?
effort. Yeah. And the same with America as well.
So you mentioned it very briefly there. You've written in lots of different genres. In fact, you were on a panel yesterday about kind of cross-genre pollination.
Jack of all genres, master of none.
Well, I don't know about that. So you have written horror, fantasy. You're a screenwriter as well. You love a bit of supernatural stuff. You're a young adult.
Yeah.
Period serial killer stuff. I mean,
I'll have a go them all.
Yeah, I'll have a go. Have a go, Sarah. That's what we'll call you now.
It's written on the toilet wall. Sorry, take that back.
So why now? Why go into the kind of adult psychological thriller? What was it that kind of made you jump over
I've always liked crime stories, and I've written, you know, a fair few in various guises. And I'd written 13 Minutes, which is a YA psychological thriller. So that, which Netflix have picked up. So that was kind of a good prelim. But I found that I was reading, I think since Gone Girl, I, like everybody else in the nation, got into that kind of griplet, you know, whatever we want to call it.
Do you like the term? Do you like these kind of badges?
I don't really care what they call it. We know what they mean by it. You know, domestic noir, griplet, psychological thriller, I guess would be what I would normally say, but I'm tired and griplet's shorter. But I was reading a lot of them. And, you know, even like Daphne du Maurier is one of my favourite authors, and a lot of her stuff, it has that tone. You know, Rebecca's very much a, you know, original psychological thriller. So I just thought I wanted to give one a go, and I wanted to do something a bit different with it. And I also, you know, I'm not stupid, I want a career, and I thought I could maybe bring something slightly different to these, you know, hopefully. We'll see. That sounds awful. It always sounds like you're denigrating other writers, which I don't mean by that.
No, I know what you mean.
But, you know, yeah. I think I had something else to add to it. If I was just going to repeat what someone else had done, I wouldn't have wanted to
I think that's the case with any writer.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? It's like why I think I remember at Harrogate, Laura Lippman talking on a panel saying writers, really, if you come down to it, they're kind of egotists, really, because they always think...
Mine's going to be different.
Mine's going to be different. Yeah. And kind of disregard like millions of novels that have written in like 300-400 years. And it's like, no, mine's going to be different.
Mine's
going
to be totally different.
So we mentioned the genres there, and each of them had their own kind of conventions and rules, if you like. What was it like coming over into the psychological thriller? What did you find?
The one thing I really, really like about psychological thrillers is they don't tend to have a policeman.
Right.
So you don't have to worry about the procedural side of things, which I've done before, but it is a lot of research. And I am essentially
a really lazy person.
But also I'm much more interested in the, you know, the human interaction and the human character analysis, which in psychological thrillers, that's what it's all about, isn't it? It's about the mistrust. It's about... So, I mean, I think... It plays out like you have to lay the clues like you do with the crime novel, but I think you're much more with every single character in a psychological thriller. With the crime novel, the policeman is your main character, and some of them don't even put the viewpoint of the killer in, you know, so you don't know really quite who's what and how and where. But I like damaged people, and psychological thrillers is a really good place to have them.
Yes, absolutely. So let's talk about Behind Her Eyes then. You've got your three main characters, David, Adele and Louise.
Yeah.
What is the setup there?
Well, and it sounds very mundane, but it's a single mother, Louise, meets a man in a bar, thinks he's fabulous, finds out he's her new boss. And then while telling herself she's not going to start an affair with him, she starts an affair with him in the way that most affairs start. And then she accidentally becomes friends with his wife, which she keeps secret from him. So she's kind of, to a certain extent, having these sort of affairs with each of them, even though one is sort of non-sexual. And she starts to realise there's something really badly wrong in their marriage. And really, who is manipulating who in the three of them, really. And then it all goes very, very, very horribly wrong.
Even wronger.
Even wronger for them. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned this whole kind of... the manipulation, the mistrust, the kind of psychosexual politics, the relationship dynamics. But these seem to be like the key kind of elements in this kind of new wave of psychological thrillers. Why do you think that is at this time?
Well, I think that we live in a world that's very connected. So you can, you know, social media is everywhere. You've got everyone is linked to everybody. So I think... our fears have changed, especially on a small scale, our fears. We all still worry about getting murdered or run over and blown up and those, but they're kind of, we're nervous of them, but we don't impinge on our daily lives. But I do think that we worry about people taking our families or our husbands or our wives or taking the rug out, because we're working so hard to keep our heads above water at the moment in the world, I think most people, that we worry about an interloper coming into our home, as it were. So I guess it's kind of the crime equivalent of those home invasion horror films. But I think, you know, 20 years ago, even before mobile phones, let's say 30 years ago, you know, if you came to a convention and you met someone you thought was quite hot and you got drunk with them, and you might have flirted, but then you'd go away, you wouldn't see them for a year, and you go back to your normal life, you'd talk yourself out of it, you'd be sensible. Whereas these days, I'm not saying that conventions, dear Christ, you know, we're all too hungover, but you know, they're not a hotbed of sexual passion. But you know, if you meet someone that you like, they can get drunk and email you, Facebook you, Twitter you, and then before you know it, this flirtation can go further and you're both in trouble. So I think that is a much more of a threat to people. And so I think we all worry about that kind of thing. And women, you know, we spend a lot of time pretending to be something. You know, we put makeup on, we put our best clothes on, we do this, we do that. And then when we're sort of settled in a relationship and that slides away, we don't feel so attractive. So then we worry about all the other women we've been trained to be competitive.
And of course, and you mentioned social, I think social media is a really interesting point because it adds a layer of kind of status envy.
Yeah, massively.
So you've got those kind of
pressures. You have those perfect lives. I mean, I have a friend of mine who, I mentioned on a panel this morning that I think Muswell Hill is where twats go to live. So I have a lot of friends.
Muswell Hill, North London, listeners in the North.
But you know, I love Muswell Hill. It's like, to me, it's an aspirational place, you know? So I think maybe that's why I say, twats go there, because I don't live there. But I have friends who live there, and a screenwriter, director friend of mine, aspirational life, and his wife is in a band, aspirational life. And I said to them, I said, texted him one day and I said, oh God, look at everybody's Facebooks this morning. Everyone's got such fabulous lives. And he was like, do you know what? Everyone you just, I was listing the people like, oh, John is doing this and you're doing that and Abby's doing that. And he was like, yeah. And every single one of those people has been saying the same thing about your Facebook recently. And you think we're all so busy hiding our, the terrible sides of our lives and being quick to go, hey, look at this, look at my book, look at that, look at this, you know?
So social media and modern life in general, I guess, has, we're sort of expected to put this veneer of perfection. So is that kind of...
And I wonder if we just don't work as hard at things as maybe our parents' generations did.
No, because it's all at the click of a button.
Yeah, everything's disposable. No one darns a sock anymore, do they? No. I mean, to be fair, I've never darned a sock in my life. No, but, you know, you can go to Primark and get 5 pairs for £1. So everything is disposable. Like, that worries me a little bit.
Now, I read in an interview recently, easy for me to say.
So you can tell we're on Sunday morning at Grindfest.
You said we implicitly don't trust each other. Mm. What did you mean by that? And how does it relate to stories?
Yeah, I was talking about women at the time. And I, you know, I've said this a few times now. And I think it's when you're young, especially young women implicitly don't trust each other. And I've asked young, I mean, obviously it's like a long time ago for me, but I remember we make each other feel insecure because we all think we're faking it a little bit. And you think other women aren't, you know, someone's always got perfect hair or they've got, you know, they've got
this
perfect
idea
clothes.
Perfection
it's
again,
a great figure, etc. And so women have been, you know, men are pack animals. They will find their place in the hierarchy. And that's why criminal gangs are invariably men, you know, because they will trust each other with their freedom and their life. And they will do what the boss tells them. Women, on the other hand, we're like cats. You know, like it takes us a little while to let people into our territory. We take a little evaluation. That's why, you know, the biggest thing the feminist movement could understand or take on board, which we all, and I do it, we try and pretend it doesn't exist. Women are pretty horrible to each other a lot of the time because we've had years of conditioning to be insecure about each other. And only when you get in your 40s do you think, Jesus, that was a waste of 20 years. You know, we could have all helped each other and we'd have been like on top now. This is, so I think that, with women especially, we are insecure about, we're always comparing ourselves with other women in a way that I'm not sure men do.
Different kind of territorial.
Yeah, because we've been very conditioned to try and be the most attractive, the funniest, the most, you know, and it's always been about, for centuries, securing our place in the world through the attention of a man because we weren't able to own anything or vote or whatever. So I think that's still in our mindset, you know, like my mum still to this day is like, oh, why can't you just marry a rich man? And she says, well, I'm only joking. And I'm like, you said an awful lot for someone who's joking. Right. You know, how about I've just become a rich woman?
Yes.
You know, that's what I want to do.
Let's forget the man.
Exactly. Yes. You know, and then all the beautiful young men can come and try and marry me.
Yes.
I'll work with that.
A beautiful poor man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He can sod off.
What about marriage, though? Because obviously this deals with a marriage, I guess. What's your views on marriage and that kind of, the kind of dynamics and the politics within marriage? That's something that you've obviously explored.
Yeah,
well,
I'm quite fascinated by long-term relationships as a whole because I'm really rubbish at them. Right, you know, like I just can't do them. I think 3 years has been my max. And, you know, I think people get bored very quickly in long-term relationships. But there is a, you know, I think the one thing I've learned is that actually all the things that we think are important, like that passion, that all that stuff at the beginning. It is important, but companionship and friendship and that trust element is maybe the more important thing. But I've also, you know, been out with friends before, especially when their children were young and they were like, oh, they hadn't had sex for ages, whatever. And I was like, ladies, you need to start getting back on that saddle because otherwise your husbands are trying to shag women like me. You know, and that's not because they don't love you. It's because men feel needed in a different way to how women feel. You know, there's men are simple creatures.
You know? Yes, I can vouch for that.
But I think, and I know I'm simplifying, but I think the way people view marriages, the genders is different. And I think women find it much harder to say things like, oh, I'm not, you know, they'll easily say, I'm not feeling very attractive. And men don't, men are like, I'll still shake you. You know, but it's not, we look at, we feel lonely in our marriages in different ways, I think.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
But when people find their way through that, I mean, I've got friends who are really happily married and I've got friends who've had trouble. So it's been really fascinating to watch. But I do think that it's finding that the happiness in the marriage is very hard, I think, sustainably.
And it brings me nicely onto my next
question.
This
is like therapy for me.
I know.
It's like, why is Sarah not married? Well.
That'd be £90 please for that. it's this idea, also this idea of doing, like an affair, for instance, is doing, why are humans drawn to something that they should. Why are they drawn to kind of the fire? Why are they drawn to doing something that they know is
danger?
Why are we like that?
I think with affairs, and I think it's often very simple, is that early days of a romance is like a drug. And that is, they say, it's like a madness, isn't it? And I think it makes you feel young. It makes you feel invigorated. It makes you feel excited in a way that, you know, when you've been doing it with the same person every night for 20 years, it's not going to have the same thing. And so I think we're drawn to feeling, something that makes us feel good about ourselves, you know, is a flirtation. It always is, always going to make people feel good about themselves. But, you know, I think it's learning to flirt with the person you're married to is the way forward most people, you know, like keep that going in the marriage, which I think, again, is the thing that you learn as you get older, is that I think people get married young and they take it for granted. Mm-hmm. They take all that stuff for granted, because when you're young, you think that's going to keep going, don't you?
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I think we're just naturally, it's all about the ego, I think, affairs. Mm. Yeah, sex, you know, that's a natural thing. And I also think people used to die a lot younger.
Yes,
you know, so
right.
You'd be married for maybe 10 years and,
right.
and then one of you popped your clogs and then you remarry, you know? So you kind of get that changeover.
Yeah.
I do think that marriages should come with a 10-year expiry date.
Right.
You know, and then there's a get-out clause where no one gets ripped off by the other half. And, but then in the year before, if you really want to stay married to that person, you're going to start
contract.
Thinking, actually, I really like this person. I need to start putting my lippy on once a week again, and they need to start going to the gym or, you know, like do the things that make you feel good about each other.
Now, you mentioned the twist.
The twist.
The twist, but obviously I want to talk about it, but I can't talk about it for listeners who haven't read the book yet. I'm interested, though, in how you construct twist. Do you start from the back and go, work backwards?
Yeah.
Or do you kind of plot stuff out? How do you work such a huge
twist? Well, twist or no twist, I like to know the ending of my book before I start.
Right.
You know, even if it's like a vague ending. But with this one... the book came about in an unusual way, in that I was at a convention in London, a fantasy and sci-fi convention, actually a big one, LongCon it was called. And I remember standing in the bar there, as one does, and looking around, and there were people getting big deals and stuff. And I'm not a great believer in envy of other writers, because that way lies madness. You're only in competition with yourself. And if someone gets £1 million deal, there's room for, you know, it's not going to stop anyone else getting one. So I think you can go crazy. But I was having a moment of, how long can I sustain this career? Because I'm not getting the big bucks, so no one's putting the push behind the books, and how long can this go on for? And Natasha Barden at HarperCollins came and said, do you fancy a coffee? And so we went and had a beer. And she just basically said, we want you to write for us. And I was like, well, that's great, but I got nothing. And she said, well, just come up with something I can pitch. It doesn't have to be brilliant, which of course means it has to be brilliant. So I went away, and it was an awful week. I was looking after my friend's dog and had to have it put down. Oh. Yeah, that was not good. And then, you know, worse, a very good friend of mine, writer Graham Joyce, died that week. Mm. And I was really, so I'm trying to come up with this idea, as well as having all this stuff going on. And I wanted to write about affairs, because I think they're sort of a modern malaise, as it were, modern fear. And so I also thought, it's got to have a murder, because, you know, these books do. And I was coming up with, I had this like brainstorming, and I couldn't get anything. So I thought, right, I'm going to go to the pub. So I went and I sat down with a glass of wine. And
the best ideas.
And the minute I sat down, I just had this, what if? And I had all my characters laid out, and I just suddenly had this moment. And then I thought, oh, that's it. I've got the ending. And I knew then that it was going to be a special book. And so I literally closed my notebook. And Stav Sherez, I was living in Chiswick, and he literally lived like two doors away. So I texted him, I was like, I'm in the Roebuck, fancy a glass of wine? And he was like, yeah, I'm coming. So, yeah. So I then worked, obviously, towards that ending, which was harder than I thought it was going to be.
Right, okay. That's
writing one of those characters was very difficult.
What do you think, I'm just going to wrap this up now, but what do you think about twists in general? There seems to be a lot of emphasis placed on
the
twists.
It's a real big thing at the moment, isn't it?
It really is. How do you feel about, do you feel more pressure to come up with a twist?
Well,
or what's,
when
what,
I was planning the second one, mm-hmm. come and try it, which I've nearly finished, and I went to, it sounds like my life is just a constant trip to pubs, but I was meeting up with Will Hill and Tom Pollock, who are both some very good YA authors, and we were in this bar in London, and I said, I don't know how am I going to beat that twist? And they said, and it stuck, I think it was Tom Pollock actually, and he said, do not try and out-twist yourself. That way lies M. Night Shyamalan. And I was like, okay. So I've still got a twist, because I think it's nice to have a little bit of a reversal. Yeah. But I also think there are lots of books that don't have twists that are great books. And I think I think you people are, it's like the unreliable narrator. Everyone is looking for them now. Every book you read, you're like, okay, which one of these people is, especially first, and I, you know, and I'm guilty of doing it, and I've done it in the second one, first person narrator, switching voice, switching characters. But, you know, I think that the way there are a lot of very great books that have a reveal, but they don't have a massive twist. And I don't think, I think people can get carried away looking for a twist and actually neglect
miss
the rest
the story
of the book.
And the characters, would it be a twist not to have a twist now? Are people looking so hard for that?
I think it depends what kind of book. Yeah, I mean, I've read some really good books which have got more reveals than twists. I've just read Tammy Cohen's They All Fall Down, which isn't out yet. And it's a great, great conceit. It's set in a woman's in like a mental health care unit because she's had this breakdown and something to do with her baby, and you know, you don't really know what's happening. But there's, so there's people in there for anorexia, and they're all got these big issues, and a couple of them have died, and she thinks they've been murdered, but who's going to believe you when you're in the crazy house?
Right, okay.
It's a really nice conceit.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say that it has a massive twist, but it's lots of reveals, you know? So I think as long as you keep people guessing and interested, and then you give them a satisfying ending, I don't think a twist is necessarily always the way. I certainly don't intend to write books with twists for the rest of my life, because also, although what I found is quite interesting, a lot of TV companies have been wanting meetings because they really want twists.
Right, that's
so
interesting.
I have just sold a pitch on with a great twist.
So the twist will be with us for a little while.
I think everyone loves a twist. We always have, ever since, you know, Sixth Sense. And, although I guessed that.
Did you?
Yeah, straight away.
All right, well, that's your lot, Sarah. Thank you so much for joining us. And good luck with the second book.
Thank you. Fingers crossed.
And with that, it's back to you in the studio, Mark.
Thanks, Paul. We'll be back next week, where I'll be talking to award-winning screenwriter Danny Brocklehurst and the amazing actress Mianna Buring about the new BBC One show In the Dark, which I may have had something to do with. In the meantime, you can find out more about A Stab in the Dark at uktv.co.uk/astabinthedark, or get in touch with us on Twitter, #astabinthedark. Oh, and don't forget to review us on your podcast app. Your feedback really does make a difference. It makes us very, very happy. So if you like the show, please rate and review us. And just a quick reminder, you can watch the very best crime drama every day on UK TV channels Alibi and Drama. And thanks to our producers Paul Hirons, Joel Porter and John Lemon. My name's Mark Billingham, and thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.